Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, wildlife populations are in decline, and according to our next guest, the cause may be the loss of our native plants. Doug Tallamy is our guest. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and his most recent book is Nature's Best Hope. It's a New York Times bestseller, and we're going to talk with him about the decline of insects, birds, and other wildlife and find out what you and I can do to help. And certainly love to hear from you. Have you read Doug's books? What questions do you have for him? Join in. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Doug Tallamy, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great. Your book, Nature's Best Hope, I think that's the most recent of your books on, and I'm just wondering, what started your interest in biodiversity?
Oh, I think I was born that way. From the earliest days, I've been attracted to any living thing around me. Can't take any credit for it. It just was my interest. You know, I've got a brother and a sister. They grew up in the same house. We had the same exposure, and they just don't have the same interests. So it's, you know, I really was born that way.
Well, your book made a big impression on a lot of people, including a number of guests to my show. Your name is, and that book has come up many, many times. Why do you think it's struck such a chord?
I think the timing is right, and I won't take any credit for that. You know, we've had a lot of very scary headlines in recent years. You mentioned a few of them. We've got global insect decline, the insect apocalypse is here. We've lost 3 billion breeding birds in North America in the last 50 years. The UN says we're going to lose a million species in the next 20 years. The National or World Wildlife Fund says we've lost 2/3 of the Earth's wildlife. People don't want to hear that. It upsets them, and they want to know what they can do. And this book just happens to tell them what they can do. So it's timely and fitting with the urgent. It's a biological crisis around the world. So it is a crisis, but it does have a grassroots solution, and that includes you and me. So that's why people are interested, I think.
Yeah, so talk about the basic premise of your book.
The basic premise is that every person on the planet requires a healthy ecosystem. That's what keeps us alive. It's our life support system, which means everybody on the planet has a responsibility in good earth stewardship. And that's not the way our society's set up. We've got, a few specialists, a few ecologists, a few conservation biologists, and they're supposed to take care of the earth. Everybody else seems to have a green light to destroy it. That makes no sense at all. So the premise is we can't keep doing that. We've got to have healthy ecosystems everywhere, not just in parks and preserves. It's obvious that the conservation efforts we've made so far are not working. Because if they were working, we wouldn't have all these terrible declines. So we're going to have to do conservation outside of our parks and preserves, in addition to it, not instead of. And that means we have to practice conservation where we live, where we work, where we play, even where we farm. Or it's just not going to turn out well for us.
Yeah. So what do we do at home?
Well, there are four things that every landscape has to contribute to the local ecosystem. One is that it has to support a viable food web. So by that, I mean, plants are capturing energy from the sun and turning it into food. If they don't pass that energy on to animals, then you don't have any animals. And if you don't have any animals, you don't have a functional ecosystem. So the plants you choose for your landscape have to be willing to share that energy that they have captured in order to support animal life around you. So that's one thing. We have to have viable and diverse populations of pollinators. And you hear all the time, well, we need pollinators because they pollinate a third of our crops. It's probably closer to a 12th of our crops. And then people say, well, I don't live next to a farm, so I don't need any pollinators. I don't like that argument. You know, we need pollinators because they pollinate 80% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants. Where do we need these pollinators? Everywhere. Everywhere you need plants, not just next to farms. So that's number two. Support the pollinators, number one, is support that viable food web. The third thing we need to do, or every landscape needs to do, is sequester carbon, pull carbon out of the atmosphere and lock it up in plant tissues, and then pump the extra carbon into the ground for long-term storage. And then finally, every landscape has to be managing the watershed that it lies in. Everybody lives in a watershed. Nobody has the ethical right to destroy that watershed. So what can the homeowner do? They can look at their property and say, is my property doing all four of those things? And, you know, there's not one of us who can't do each one of those things better than we're already doing. The easiest thing to do is to cut the area of lawn that you have in half, because lawn doesn't do any of those things well. It's a primary culprit in our biodiversity decline. So that's one place to start. I could ramble on forever, so I'll wait for you to ask another question.
I was sitting here taking notes. Well, yeah, cutting lawns in half. But I, as you were talking about food web plants, I was thinking, well, are all of the plants that we put out there good? Or are there plants that we put out there that aren't so good?
Well, you know, good at what is the question. So are all of them good at supporting food webs? No. The plants we bring in from other continents are terrible at doing that. Most vertebrates, most animals with a backbone do not eat plants directly. They typically eat an invertebrate that ate plants. That invertebrate is typically insects. And the insects that pass on more energy from plants to other animals more than anything else are caterpillars. So the real question is, how well do your plants support caterpillars? And plants from Asia or South America or all these places we bring them in from are terrible at supporting North American caterpillars because plants defend themselves from caterpillars. They don't want to be eaten. And our caterpillars can only eat the plants. They have evolved the adaptations for circumventing those plant defenses. For example, the monarch butterfly is a host plant specialist on milkweeds. You can have all the crepe myrtle and all the boxwood and all the burning bush and all the hosta you want in your yard, which is, you know, these are the things we typically landscape with, and you won't support a single monarch butterfly unless you have milkweed. That's host plant specialization. Well, every 90% of the insects that eat plants are host plant specialists. So if we want to have those insects, the little things that run the world, as E.O. Wilson says, you've got to have the plants to support those insects. And those are going to be native plants.
Native plants. All right. That, you know, Owen in Wyawega has a comment for you, or a question that may relate to this. Let's go there. Owen, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. I do, you know, I understand people have the opportunity and they can choose to purchase organic products, but, you know, it's scary to watch some of the neighbors that we have. They spray their fence lines with weed killers, Roundup and different things. And then their cows lick the Roundup off from the plants because they can reach the plants because they are on the fence lines. Then they go and milk the cows. And, you know, that goes directly into our food source. And I think that we need to really try hard at a larger scale level to educate dairy processors and local politicians and even the Environmental Protection Agency about how unskillfully these products are applicated. And it's just and the people I talk to that use these products so haphazardly always have a rebuttal about why they're safe.
What is that rebuttal?
They say the same thing Monsanto says. There's no direct link that is a carcinogen. even though we know that dioxins and all those other types of chemicals have been recognized even by the United States military as being carcinogenic. So it's scary how corrupt and greedy our whole agricultural system is. And that's really created the lack of biodiversity. I remember when I was a kid, there was always milkweeds and things like that out in the pastures and meadows, and you hardly see that at all anymore.
You know, we assume that if we sell these products on the shelf in our hardware store, they must be safe, because, you know, who would be selling an unsafe product? That's problem number one. They are effective tools in managing landscapes, but like any tool, you have to use them properly. And, you know, a real pesticide applicator has training and all the do's and don'ts, but the homeowner doesn't get any of that. They just buy it off the shelf and away they go. Part of the problem is the native plants that are running our ecosystems, we have labeled weeds, milkweed, New York ironweed, Joe Pye weed. If it's called a weed, it must be bad, and then you kill it. So, you know, it's a simplistic label that we've attached to our native plants, and that's part of the problem. So the typical agricultural landscape now has corn or soybeans, and then that space between the ends of the crop and the road, which used to be, quote, weeds, it used to be the native plants, the milkweeds and the asters and all the things that supported the life around us, is now lawn. You spray Roundup Ready, and you get rid of all the, quote, weeds and replace it with lawn, and it looks nice. It makes the grower feel like he's a good land manager. But when you do that over tens of thousands of square miles of the Midwest, it's a totally dead landscape, and that's what we've done. It's not necessary. It doesn't elevate the yield of a single acre of our product. It's totally unnecessary.
Thanks for that call. Michael in Wauwatosa, comment from you.
Yes, hi. For those of us with a Christian background, I just wanted to make mention of the fact that in Genesis 2:15, the very first vocation that God ever put upon man, Genesis 2:15 says God placed the man in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And arguably the whole planet is the Garden of Eden. And we have an obligation to take care of this planet. And the other thing I wanted to say is about lawns. I used to work as a horticultural agent for a little while in Waukesha County, and I used to tell people all the time, lawns, grass is the most high-maintenance plant that you can have. You fertilize it, you water it, you mow it. You're much better off planting some perennials. So
there we go.
I agree, and both counts. For those of you who are religious, do you think God created all of these species so that we could wipe them out? I don't think so, but that's exactly what we're doing. So
we can talk some more about that. We, with our guest today, Doug Tallamy, professor in the Department of Entomology. His most recent book is Nature's Best Hope. It's a New York Times bestseller. He'll be with us right up till 12:30 today. We'll take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Doug, and I hope you'll call or email with your questions. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, talking with Doug Tallamy, professor and chair of the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware in Newark. He's working to help us better understand the way insects interact with plants and how those interactions can help diversify animal populations. And we'd love to hear from you. Are you taking Doug's advice about creating a more biodiverse community? Maybe in your own backyard, maybe in your community as a whole. What questions do you have? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And you know what? Let's take a call. Pat in Mazamani will give you a chance now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to tell Doug how much I appreciate his slant on gardening, and that I've seen him both on University of the Air and have read his books. And I wondered if he could talk a little bit more about his list of the most beneficial plants that support bird and pollinators, and maybe provide an example of how oaks and willows make the list in contrast to, say, a Bradbury pear tree. And that's all I wanted to bring up. Thank you very much for having him on.
Oh, thanks, Pat.
All right. Yeah, that's a great question, Pat. There's two issues. One is, are native plants better for wildlife than non-native plants? And the other issue is, are all native plants equally beneficial to non-native plants? So there's lots and lots of evidence that native plants support wildlife better than non-native plants. But lesser known is the fact that all native plants don't do that job equally well. There are just 5% of our native plant species that are generating 75% of the energy that drives our food webs. 14% of our native plants are generating 90% of the energy, which means 85% of our native plants are contributing, but not all that much. The genus of plant that contributes more to food web diversity and stability than any other plant in North America is oaks, Quercus. And if we measure their productivity in terms of the number of caterpillar species that they support, in the mid-Atlantic states, they support 557 species. That's 557 species of birds that depend on oaks. Nationwide, it's over 950 species. There's no other plant genus that comes close to that. But willows and native prunus, our cherries, are coming second in most counties of the country. And then you write down the list. Birches are very high. Hickories and walnuts and pines are high. But there are a number of native plants that support very little. So if I'm looking at my backyard right now, and we've got oaks, but we also have tulip trees. Tulip trees only support 21 species. It's a good native plant, but it's very common around here to have tulip tree monocultures in our forest because it's an early successional species that colonized farmland when it was abandoned back in the 30s. And you've got forests that are 95% tulip trees only supporting 21 species of bird food, where you could have some oaks in there supporting hundreds and hundreds. So there are big differences in how our plants are supporting the wildlife around us. And it gives us a tool for management. It also emphasizes the fact that when you're choosing a plant for your own landscape, plant choice really matters. So if you choose that oak, you can't do better. In most places of the country.
What about smaller plants? I mean, there are, if you got a small backyard, you're not going to be able to, perhaps, to have an oak tree growing in it, and you may want flowers of some sort, native flowers.
Right. Well, first of all, we do have some small oaks, things like the dwarf chinquapin oak, dwarf chestnut oak. They'll make acorns when they're 5 feet tall. Down south, we've got dwarf live oak. So not all oaks are gigantic, and there are opportunities to have smaller species in small yards. But it's true, your caller mentioned the most important plants for pollinators. First of all, many of our woody plants do flower and do support a lot of pollinators, but typically it's our perennials and our annuals that are making most of the pollen that are. And now it's our bees are the best pollinators that we're talking about. We've got, 4,000 species of native bees, one species of honeybee, which is non-native, and everybody's worried about the honeybee decline because they're so good at pollinating our crops. But we've got to pay attention to those native bees as well. Over a third of them are host plant specialists. They can only reproduce on the pollen of particular plants. So that's, 1,400 species of bees. So if you're going to make a pollinator garden, you want to plant the plants that support the specialist, because the generalist bees, things like honeybee and bumblebees, they can use those plants you put in for the specialists as well. But if you only put in plants for the generalists, And a lot of our non-native plants produce nectar and the bees go there, but they don't support any of the specialists. So then you lose your specialists. The best plants, again, in most parts of the country would be members of the goldenrod genus Solidago. Our perennial sunflowers, Helianthus, are very high in supporting the specialists. The various genera that asters were broken up into, they're very high. Oenothera, which is evening primrose, very high. Even our violets, our native violets, are very high in supporting our specialist bees. So when you, if you have that sunny spot and you want to take it out of lawn, put in some of those plants, and then you really help the pollinators.
Yeah. Bill in Oregon, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Over the last 12 years that we've been living in Oregon, we've witnessed a very noticeable decline in pollinators. This year in particular, especially, we were seeing more things in April than we are now. And we're in a heavily wooded subdivision surrounded by fields and farms. And we've been adding native flowers and shrubs for years. And, you know, and it's somewhat limited by, you know, things that are what's eaten by the rabbits, deer, and groundhogs. But now we're actually getting to a point where we're seeing flowers not being pollinated. You know, it's almost shocking in a way. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out, you know, what more can we do? Because I mean, we really don't. The only thing I add is some repellents that are blood meal based to keep my, you know, to keep a few flowers from getting eaten that that I care about. But love to hear your thoughts, especially if things about possibly local ordinances or things that might, you know, just alter how farm practices are done in the area. How does one get involved?
Well, you know, I'm hearing stories like this more and more, where areas that are being managed correctly still don't have the insects, and everybody's scratching their head. But one of the things that's happened in the last decade is the increased use of imidacloprids, the seed treatments on our corn, soybeans, our wheat. It's all planted with these seed coatings. And when the soil, that gets into the soil, when the soil's turned over, it gets into the dust, it gets into the rain. And it's somewhat speculative at this point, but there's growing evidence that we're getting long-distance pollution from farm practices by using these seed coatings that then get up into the wind. And they can go, you know, miles and miles and miles, and then they come down on your house and kill your insects. That's, you know, that's a worst case scenario, but it's really starting to look like that's happening. What's interesting is, you know, when you compare yield with these crops that have the seed treatment versus the crops that don't, there's no difference. The farmers are using the seed treated seeds because that's what's available for one thing, but also they don't want to take any risks. You know, what if something comes and eats my seed? I'm going to be careful. It's very cheap to buy these products. But this is where government should come in, I think. You know, we can't be doing farm practices that pollute the entire continent, particularly when it doesn't even raise productivity. There's more research that needs to be done, but that's the direction it's headed right now, and it could explain why you're not seeing your bees and other things like grasshoppers that they're just disappearing.
Hmm. So your recommendation to Bill is to keep doing what he's doing, pretty much?
Yes. And my call to action for university scientists is to really start to analyze, you know, are we getting fallout from imidacloprid seed treatments in areas distant from, you know, application? Because if we are, that needs to be regulated. That's not tolerable.
Yeah. And you may not be researching that, but do you have some studies underway, and what kinds of research are you doing?
Well, you know, on Saturday I turned 70, so my research career is starting to wind down. But we do have some projects, some small projects. It's small, but they're still important. You know, I've talked about it, but we've come to realize how important landscapes full of caterpillars are. The way we typically landscape, even if we use the right trees, even if we use those keystone plants I talked about, the way we landscape underneath those trees is really important in terms of getting those caterpillars to complete their development. So the adult moth will come lay its eggs on the oak tree, the caterpillar develops, and then it drops from the tree. And it either wiggles its way beneath the ground and pupates underground, or it spins a cocoon in the leaf litter under the tree. Now, picture a typical suburban landscape. There is no leaf litter under the tree, and the ground is mowed and compacted to the point where it's rock hard, and there's no way the caterpillar can get underground to complete its development. So so that's what we're looking at, just how bad is that in terms of caterpillar survivorship, and what can we do to make it easier on those caterpillars once they drop from the tree? And the obvious answer is you put beds under those trees so that it's not compacted. They're not going to get squished. They're not going to get mowed. The soil remains loose. And, of course, that takes area out of lawn. If we're going to cut our area of lawn in half, that's a great place to start, is to put beds. Even if it's just ground covers like wild ginger or May apples or flower, there are lots of options there. But that'll allow those caterpillars to complete the development. What about a layered landscape? Just tree and then air and then ground. You want ground covers and shrubs and understory trees, and all of that stuff can be in your yard, and it can be done tastefully. So those are the types of things we're looking at right now.
We had a question from Day in South Elgin. You've commented on tree species as which ones are better forage for birds seeking insects. She noticed a lot of galls on her hackberry leaves and some on oaks. Do birds open those? She's wondering.
It depends on where you are. Those galls are totally normal. They're part of hackberry and oak fauna. I did see a study in Colorado where small birds like the chickadees and titmice and golden crown kinglets will actually pick open those galls during the wintertime and get the insects out of there. So apparently they do help. They're not a major contributor in most ecosystems, but they are part of the trees. They're normal. I certainly would never treat the tree to get rid of the galls. They're supposed to be there.
Peter emailed that he moved to West Virginia 13 years ago from Iowa and tore up a half of his lawn and planted a prairie from seed. It is phenomenally successful with primary forbs because of moisture. Bees come from all the hives in the neighborhood, lots of moths, butterflies, hummingbirds, and so forth. So he says, tear up the lawn and plant a prairie. The seed mix was a bit expensive, but the biodiversity is worth it.
Yeah, it's true. Most people think of prairies, of course, in the Midwest, because that's where they remained. But long time ago, 8,000-9,000 years ago, when we had the big Pleistocene mammals on the continent, the mammoths and the giant sloths, and those guys were browsers, and they kept the land much more open. Closed forest canopy probably was rare, and we had savanna-like landscapes all the way to the coast. So prairie plants, most of the prairie plants you find in the Midwest also occurred in the East. But then when we killed off those mammals and all the forest closed in, we lost a lot of those plants. But prairie systems in the East are part of our historical ecological background. We had a bird, the heath hen, which didn't go extinct on Long Island until, I think, 1920 or something, because of remaining prairies. But, of course, when the European settlers got here, that was the land they plowed up first because they didn't have to take the trees down. It was they were already down. So, yeah, it's a good idea. But I will say I'm glad that your caller had success, because planting a prairie is one of the harder things that you have to do. It's not particularly easy. But when it succeeds, it is a wonderful thing.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I would very briefly like to describe what we have in our lawn, which is not a green desert, and then I have a question at the end, if I may, quickly. In our lawn, we have a succession of flowers, wildflowers. I believe they're all except maybe one, are native. Forget-me-nots, lupins, but I can't remember their name right now, but and then Black Eyed Susans and Daisies and we allow them to grow in the lawn. My husband collects seeds and then scatters them around other areas of the lawn where they haven't been growing. And we don't mow until those plants, we mow around those plants. So we have paths around the patches of plants so that they can reach their full growth and feed their roots and seeds for the next year. And in the fall, we collect the leaves off of our lawn and use them as a deep litter for our chickens over the winter, which has the advantage of not only providing material for our compost for the organic garden the next year, but also prevents any kind of odor from chickens in a very, you know, in a city. And any leaves that we aren't able to use in the deep litter, which is not a whole lot, but we just use the mulching function on the mower, chop them up and leave them on the lawn. And we have a good stand of Creeping Charlie. And my question is, there always seems to be a war against Creeping Charlie, and I don't understand why, because it's pretty, for one thing, and it is just swarmed with bees in the, you know, all kinds of flying insects. And we have wasps that if we get any aphids in the garden within a couple of days, the wasps have eaten them up and taken care of them. So we have, there are a lot of beneficial bees and wasps flying around. And Creeping Charlie is one of the earliest plants to bloom, and I don't understand why people are so up in arms against it. Is it a native?
No, it's not a native, and that's one of the reasons people are. The other one is it's pretty invasive. It won't stay where you put it, and it creeps. So, yes, it blooms, and it makes nectar, and that's why you're seeing those bees and wasps go to it. They want the sugar water, just the way the hummingbird goes to your hummingbird feeder. It did not evolve with a plastic hummingbird feeder, but it's taking advantage of that resource. So they don't care whether the nectar is native or not. It's sugar water, and they're using it for energy. But again, we get down to those specialist bees. They can't use the pollen from Creeping Charlie at all. So as it takes over, it eliminates area that could be used more productively to support the real pollinators, not just the butterflies and things that are getting nectar. The fact that, you know, it's not staying where it is, that's the problem with invasive plants. You know, the definition of an invasive plant is a non-native that's displacing productive native plants. They're tumors. They never stop growing. They just keep growing and spreading, and you're spreading something that's less productive and replacing something that's more productive. So, you know, are there worse plants from Creeping Charlie? Probably, but you know, it depends on where you are. Creeping Charlie can be pretty bad in some areas, and it is tough to get rid of. If you said, I'm going to get rid of all my Creeping Charlie, you're going to have a challenge there, and that's another reason that people have a problem with it. But otherwise, sounds like you're doing great. What you're doing is, it's called addition by subtraction. You don't have to buy any plant. You let them come in on their own, and then you only remove the ones that you don't want, and eventually you get pretty much an all-native, it'll be a prairie system in your case.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. You know, Kathy in Madison emailed that today's discussion reminded of a comment Jeff Epping from Olbrich Botanical Gardens made a couple of weeks ago. He said something like, if your leaves don't have holes in them, they're not doing their job.
Right.
And I think he was probably quoting you.
I think he was, yeah. That, you know, that is the primary job of plants when it comes to biodiversity. Plants are the only thing that's capturing energy from the sun. And you know, we're eating sunlight when we eat a plant. But again, if that plant doesn't pass on the energy in the form of something eating it, leaving a hole in the leaf, then it hasn't. You know, capturing the energy of the sun, but it hasn't passed it on to anything. So it's not performing that particular role in its ecosystem.
I love that comment as well. I'm glad Kathy called into or emailed to remind us of that Doug, your book is great. Are you working on another book?
Well, you know, I get questions on email every day, all day long, and I'm thinking I should write a book just answering questions. I haven't done it yet, but I'm keeping a lot of these questions, and I got a lot of material. So and I get asked the same questions over and over again. So I'm thinking seriously, that might be the next book.
Well, I'll tell you what, your most recent book, Nature's Best Hope, is a great one. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, Doug. Appreciate it very
much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Doug Tallamy, professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. His recent book, again, it's titled Nature's Best Hope, and it's a New York Times bestseller. And it's a great book. Tomorrow on the show, we'll take a little look at Wisconsin history, talk about Patrick Lucy. There's a book out on him. And then we'll look at museums and historic sites in Wisconsin as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.